Taxation is theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
The roads.
You boys like Mexico?
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore.
And we're back. Taxation is theft, as always. And I have with me tonight Luke Henderson, who is a contributing author for Igniting Liberty. And we have a really awesome show tonight. We're going to be talking about intellectual property. And is it good? Is it bad? Should we have it? Should we get rid of it? And some other interesting questions. If you have any questions, feel free to start dropping them in the comments. And if you're wondering why I can't talk, it's because I'm drinking a beer tonight. And I've only had two sips, so it's not really a great excuse. And Luke, what do you have?
I've got Urban Bourbon, which is from a micro distillery here in Missouri.
Nice. So before we get started, Luke has a little giveaway that he wants to do. So why don't you take it away?
Yeah, so I think it was on Thursday. I had a contest, and if you entered, you had a chance to win a free copy of the book. And I said I was going to announce the winner here today. So shaking up my hat, let me pull out a name. And our lucky winner is Mr. James Weeks himself. So James, if you send me a message where I can mail that, I will get with you on getting that set up.
This sounds rigged. Why is James Weeks always getting all the attention? Does he have to take a picture of it in a thong?
I wouldn't say no to it.
Awesome. So I guess let's kind of start out just so like everyone can have a perspective of where we're coming from. It sounds like it's not going to be too much of a boxing match between us because we already do agree on a lot, but we're going to see what happens when we get into the details. My position is that we don't need government to enforce intellectual property through IP laws and all these other sorts of things. And that we can find contractual ways to kind of protect ideas and things like that. And Luke, what's your position on IP in general?
About the same. I think current copyright patent laws just need to absolutely be abolished. I feel that they hinder innovation more than they help it. And especially with recent laws have been passed, they've been used to sue small businesses to keep them from actually releasing their products more so than anything. So I just think it's just a tool for people to use the government to get what they want in their businesses. So it definitely needs to just be abolished.
Absolutely. So let's start out with like a little bit of history on this, just because like, so when I was young and I was like into being, I mean like real young, like I don't even know when I started, maybe 5 or something. And I was like, I want to be an inventor. I want to invent things. And you know, the grown-ups who are now all old people would tell me, you know, oh, well, you need to get a patent and you need to get a copyright and you need to do all this stuff. And of course, there was the inexpensive way of doing that, which was mailing a copy to yourself, which I have no idea how well that actually protects anything in the real world these days. But so historically, the idea was kind of like, you know, and we're talking about way back in the day, right? Like a couple hundred years ago, where somebody invents a new bicycle wheel and, you know, he doesn't have the money to create a factory for it. So he wants to take it to, you know, some, what's the General Electric guy? Somebody like that, like Edison, who's gonna say, oh yeah, we can mass produce those and make you some money with it. But he doesn't want to show the idea. And then, you know, then the guy says, oh, that's a shitty idea. Get out of my office. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, he sees in the newspaper, oh, we've invented this new bicycle wheel and it has all these new benefits and we're selling them. And so now the inventor gets absolutely nothing from it. So that was kind of the theory in protecting that. Now, I think, you know, historically, and feel free to jump in if I'm misrepresenting any of this. If someone were to do that today, I think there are, you know, this was in a time where, you know, people would steal ideas and there was like, what can you do about it? And so that was like, oh, well, you know, if you ask government how to solve a problem, it's, well, we'll stick a gun in people's, we'll write some laws and stick a gun in people's face and say, obey. And so now we're actually like, I think there are some smarter ways to do that, like by signing contracts before you present an idea, so that, you know, you could still sue somebody. I realize suing still involves government, but, you know, that's basically a contractual thing versus, you know, there needs to be laws on all sorts of things. So, that said, you have anything to add to that? Does that sound about right?
Yeah, and just actually, even the history of copyright laws is even worse than just that, because, like, the first copyright law was actually in England called the Statute of Anne, and it originally gave only the writers and the printing guilds the ability to make books. Well, then the writers and stuff like that didn't like that, so they had that law abolished, and then so the guilds, they wanted that power back, so they just slowly tried to creep the idea into the authors that, like, hey, you need this to protect your thing, so only you can make copies. But it was really for so they could have that business back. So, like, IP laws have just been bad, I think, since the dawn of time. Even though, like, the intentions maybe on the small business owner side are good. Like, I want to be able to make money off my work. That I don't want to have it stolen by someone and then, like, just be out of that for the rest of my life.
Right. So it sounds like this was kind of, we could compare it to, like, the taxi scam, where only the licensed taxis are allowed to operate, and then everybody else, you have to, you know, get hired for the taxi company. That sounds kind of like what the printers were doing. So it sounds like if you abolish IP, then anybody can write their own book and they can start, you know, they can self-publish or do whatever they want. But then comes along the problem, what happens if somebody wants to say, hey, this is a great book, let me just make a copy of it and stick my name on the cover and go ahead and resell it. What kind of, you know, obviously that's where copyright law comes in. But of course, you know, there's like the, you know, the way we used to plagiarize in high school when we have to write a report and it's like, Hitler took power in, what was it, 19 something. And then you have to rewrite it in your own words. So in 19, whatever, Hitler took power. And so, you know, you're just rewording it. And so, you know, I'm sure there's a million different statutes to handle cases like that. If somebody wants to copy your entire book and just change the order of the sentences. But, you know, so without IP, there is the fear that, hey, I'm going to publish my own book. I'm going to self-publish it because I don't have to go through a big company. But now what? Now, how do I protect that?
Yeah, and honestly, today I think it's getting easier and easier to do that without fearing that, because, like, especially if you release it only as an electronic edition, like, it's less easy to copy, even though it is more mass producible. And because more people can buy copies easier, like, for cheaper, more people are going to know if something comes out that's a fraud. Because if you have a great book, and, you know, the hardback $20, but the electronic copy's $3, like, you might sell 100,000 of those. So by the time I think it gets to the point where someone tries to copy that, like, people would know. And that's where it gets kind of iffy for me, because then it's not that the authors are trying to protect their work. They're trying to control who specifically can distribute it, which, I mean, ideas need to be distributed freely if we want to get better, if we want to innovate, if we want to make the society a better place.
Right. I completely agree. I'm just thinking, like, okay, so let me give you an example. There was a shirt that has, it's got a picture of a guy, you know, with his arms out and another guy on his knees patting him down. And it says, it's not gay if it's TSA. this is a shirt that I created and I put on the Taxation is Theft website. And a while later, I saw somebody else basically copied the exact same idea. They redesigned it a little bit. And there's a picture that's been going viral of this guy with this big beard in an airport getting patted down by the TSA wearing that shirt. So now, of course, I'm not that upset about it, because the whole purpose of the whole taxation is theft thing is really to get the message out there. So I'm happy that somebody else took the idea and they're spreading the message. Other people might not be so happy with that because this might be their bread and butter and that's how they make money. But the reality is, when I look at him, you know, I'm not like, from a perspective, I could just say, yeah, I'm mad and that guy sucks. But realistically, if I were to objectively compare the two, he did a better job at marketing and he got a lot more people to see. I don't know if he sold more shirts, but he got a lot more people to see the shirts. And if you Google the shirt, his version of the shirt actually shows up in like Amazon Marketplace. It's on 500 different products, hoodies, mugs, like everything. He did a good job in marketing it. And I wish I had the time and the knowledge to do all that stuff. But the reality is, if somebody finds that shirt and, you know, it doesn't have like an author's name or anything on it, and they just search, it's not Gabe, it's TSA, and they see it on Amazon, how do they know that's the original? And are people even going to care if it's the original? And if I were one, you know, a person who's just like really mad that my idea was stolen, what would I be able to do about it in a world with no IP laws?
Well, and actually right now you actually can't really do much about shirts because the fashion industry has no intellectual property laws, because like you said, it's super easy to make a imitation that's not exactly the same and then sell it. And people don't necessarily always care about the brand when it comes to clothing, especially cheap clothing. So in one of my essays that I wrote for the book, I talk of an example from the movie Serendipity, where these two, Kate Beckinsale and Molly Shannon, their characters go by this guy who's selling purses on the street, and they pull up the imitation purse. It was an imitation Prada purse, and the only difference really was that it had an O instead of an A. It said Prado, but they bought it anyway because it looks like Prada. So, right. Like, even looking like the original thing, like, gives it value, even if it's not what the brand is, even if it's not the $1,000 Prada purse. And, like, that is something that can be marketable if, again, like you said, if you would have taken the time to really push it and make sure that you had it on every outlet possible, then maybe people would know your shirt's the original, and then that's a cheap knockoff. So when you're releasing a product, like, it's really important that you're prepared. You are prepared to get it out there. You're prepared to be the first to market. You're prepared to be the best at market when you launch.
Right. Yeah, those are all really good points. And I will say, when he redesigned the shirt, it looked better than my design anyway. So so he would have beat me there too. But yeah, so that's all really interesting. And you know, when you talk about like Prada bags, and I saw there was a thread going on today about people asking, you know, what's a better investment, investing in a Prada bag or a car? And the conversation was talking about how you can buy these bags that are $2,000 or $3,000, and 10 or 20 years later, they're worth like 50. And I'm just like, is this really a thing? And this is like, it's insane, because like literally, you know, these bags are manufactured. They might, like, the actual cost of materials and labor are like nothing. And you can have, you know, sometimes, I don't know if they do it with the, they probably do it with the bags, but like they have, you know, a Chinese manufacturer who will actually produce like 1,000 of them for Prada, and then they'll produce 1,000 for themselves, and they'll just stick different labels on them. And it's like the exact same product. And then there's this, it's just a perceived value that, oh, this one's worth so much more and this one's not.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really crazy how that all works. And, you know, so like, I get the idea, like, well, we came up with the design and we marketed the product and we want to sell these things for 2,000. It's not fair that, and you know, 1,900 of that is profit, or 1,950 is profit. It's not fair that they sell these other ones for $100 and make $50 profit, and they're taking that away from us. It's really difficult to say that, because, you know, the people who buy the $100 versions, first of all, are those people who really believe that it's the authentic ones? Are those people who really would be willing to pay $2,000 for the authentic one if the knockoff didn't exist? These are all really, really interesting questions. And it's, you know, like that's the one that I've always asked myself about the music industry. Like, you know, if somebody bootlegs a song, the artist complains, well, you stole that song that's worth $1 from me, so you owe me $1. But it's
but they're buying it because it's a bootleg of them. If it was a bootleg of some random artist no one ever heard of, they wouldn't buy it.
Well, I mean, not necessarily a bootleg, but like let's say I meant bootlegging as in like downloading a studio version of a song. If you so like let's say you download like the latest Metallica album, right? And they're like, "Oh, that's that's $15 that you stole from us." But I might be like, "Well, Metallica's kind of sucked lately, so I like if that wasn't available for free, I wouldn't have bought it anyway." So, you know, am I really stealing anything?
Yeah.
So there's
and a lot of artists nowadays don't make money off recordings. They make money mostly on live concerts, and a live concert's something that you can't exactly mimic that experience with a video or with a recording. Like, you know, you're bumping into people, they're screaming, they're shouting, it's so loud that your ears ring the next day. Like, those are experiences that you can't mimic unless you're there. And so that's like Prince, before he died, his latest album, he gave it away in newspapers in London, and if you brought the CD, you got into his concert, because he knows if you go to a concert, you're probably going to buy a t-shirt, you're going to buy, you know, alcohol. Oh, wow. Which normally artists get a portion of those proceeds. So yeah, artists don't really make money off recordings anymore, but they certainly want to cling to it if you try to copy it.
Yeah, well, I don't even think they ever did, really, because that was always, you know, the record labels would take most of it. They'd sell the CD for like $16, and then the artist would get like 50 cents or something insane out of it.
Maybe $1. And there's plenty of cases where the record company would just screw the artist out of every right. Like Kansas, the band Kansas is like the biggest example of that. They signed away all their publishing rights because they just were thinking publishing meant, oh, we're not going to release any sheet music or anything like that. So yeah, that's fine. But no, if you release your publishing rights, it means you don't get any royalties. You don't get any licensing fees that would come from that. You don't have, basically you have the right to distribute your music how you want to. Now, if there were no IP laws, then this would have just been a bad contract, and they could have maybe taken it to court and tried to get it resettled. But
right. So now, how would this work without IP laws? I've always thought, you know, if somebody buys a CD, you could just say, well, I'm not going to sell it to you unless you sign this agreement saying that you will not copy it, or you won't give it to anybody else to copy, or, you know, something like that. Or, you know, you walk in, you buy a movie ticket, and as buying a movie ticket, you know, maybe it's just checking the box. I agree to the terms and conditions. I will not smuggle in a video camera to try and make a bootleg copy of this. And then if you actually did, then, you know, the person responsible for that would be the person who could be suable. And it wouldn't be like there would be a government task force out there doing it with our tax money. It would be, if the company really wanted to track that person down, it would be up to them to foot the bill for that, since it's, you know, they are the ones who are going to benefit once this person is brought to justice and sued. What do you think about that type of thing?
I think that we're already doing things to make sure that recordings aren't copied, like using Spotify and other streaming services. Like, you can't download most recordings from Spotify, but artists still get paid if their music gets listened to on Spotify. Now, I think Spotify, because the streaming's kind of an ambiguous thing is when it comes to copyright law, they don't pay their artists hardly anything. Like, I think they get a third of a cent per listen. So if you're a small artist, that's not a lot. But if you're Taylor Swift and you have a million daily listeners, you know, that's like $30,000. $30,000 a day you're getting. So right. I think that that's one. Two is, I know, like, in the classical music, which I'm really involved in, like, a lot of composers are doing nowadays is they're renting out the sheet music. So after you're done performing their music, you have to return it. And on the sheet music, they'll print, you know, like, this was rented to such and such person. So if someone makes a copy and gives it to someone, then there's proof that whoever made the copy. And so, I like it because it makes sheet music cheaper, because you don't have to pay for the possibility that they might copy it, distribute it on their own. Like, you can know that you're going to get it back and that they're not going to send it to anyone else for free. And there's just a lot of things like that. I think using technology and all that will make it a lot easier to protect your own property without having to use the government to do it. Especially since, like the things that they're worried about with their copying are pretty well already happening. It's just now they have, you know, a military basically behind them to enforce it if someone gets caught.
Right. Yeah, and you know, that's always been an interesting point too. Like, when I guess LimeWire or Napster or any of those were the big thing, that was because, you know, you had two options to get music. You buy the CD or you pirate it. Now it's like, and then it turned into movies. People were doing that with movies. And now it's like, it's so easy to just get an entire collection of movies by subscribing to Netflix. And it's not a whole lot of money. And there are a lot of movies that you can watch there. And you don't have to like worry about, you know, giving your computer AIDS, as they say, you know, downloading viruses, trying to get bootlegs and all this other stuff. So that's really interesting. And also, you know, to your point about the, putting the name on who the music was rented to, you see that all the time. I mean, that's in the DRM. There's watermarks. I was on a flight the other day where, you know, they have the little screen in the back of the chairs, and as you're watching movies, like every 15 minutes, it just says like provided by Delta or something like that. So you know if somebody's like sitting there with their phone trying to record a movie in an airplane, which is, I don't know, that's just a terrible idea to begin with. You know that came from Delta. And you know, they do this with the Oscar screeners. I'm sure each one that, so the Oscars, you know, they send out the movies so that all of the voters in the industry can watch the movies before they can vote on who the Oscar is going to. They do the same thing, and I'm sure with them it's, you know, it's more hidden, it's digital, and it's probably even unique for every person that they send the copy out to, so that they know if, you know, if you're bootlegging these movies, we know exactly who did it. So yeah, but you know, this is new technology that maybe they didn't have when they started creating IP laws. So it's, I guess maybe it's easier for us to say IP laws aren't necessary now because of that.
And it's just, it was a lot harder when we were first recording music, because, you know, it was first being, you know, inscribed on wax cylinders, and then it was being pressed into vinyl, and the equipment to press something in the vinyl was pretty expensive. So only if you had a recording studio, that was the only way you can make copies. So right. Yeah, it only really became a big issue with the implement of CDs and computers, where you could burn CDs rather quickly. And then you started to be able to just digitally, you know, send them to your friends through files. So it's just...
Right.
Yeah, it really only became a huge problem recently.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. You know, I guess, you know, like they used to copy comics with Silly Putty. I guess you could do the same with a record, but I don't know if that would have the resolution to get you a solid playback.
It would be like having, you know, the cell phone recording of someone in the movie theater.
Right. So that's pretty funny, but yeah, so that's interesting. So I guess, you know, in a world without IP, we'd really rely on the companies, because, you know, it's like, what's a good way to put this? If you're producing something, you know, there's the little thing where you cut out, you fold up paper and you cut it with scissors and then you open it up and it's like a bunch of guys holding hands. Let's say you do that, right? And you're like, this is my beautiful design, and you start putting it all over the place, and then somebody's like, oh, I know how to do this. Like, he just folded the paper and he cut it. I can copy that. So this is a type of copying that doesn't really take any sort of technology. But you know, the question is, okay, well, can you copyright something like that? I mean, somebody, you know, we're talking about like producing a physical thing. And if you think about it, like if IP laws were strict enough, we could be living in a world where only one company manufactures cars. Because the first person to invent the car would have been like, I'm going to patent this, and nobody can create anything that has four wheels and a motor on it. And then what? We'd be living in a world with like a really crappy monopoly, and the prices would be ridiculously high. Nobody could afford a car. They'd probably be crappy. You know, there'd be no innovation or competition. So to a certain degree, you do want people to be able to copy and improve on something.
Yeah, And it's like, when I was getting my music degree, one of the things that one of my history professors would tell me all the time was, there is a quote by, I think it was a Stravinsky, he's a Russian composer, who said that good composers borrow, great composers steal. And when you study these composers' music, like, they're borrowing ideas from their friends all the time. And it wasn't because they thought it was good and they thought that they could do better and make more copy. Half the time it's for flattery. It's like, hey, you're my friend, I really love this thing you wrote, so I want to, you know, do something on it. And so, like, I have no qualms using other people's stuff, especially in the public domain. Because, like, that's what music, I think, is supposed to be. It's supposed to be, like, using the things you love and making them better. So when I hear recently that, you know, Jack White takes writing credits for this Israeli singer Nettie's song, like, it's just ridiculous. Especially when they don't... It's similar, but it's not 100% the same thing. Like, so it's not a exact copy. And it's just...
Yeah, so let's talk about, like, how much of this was actually copied in this?
Okay, so just you know, Jack White's Seven Nation Army is pretty well entirely one bass line that's doom, 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 doom. And this song by Nettie is called Toy. And the chorus has like a little trumpet part that goes bum, 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 ba, ba, dum. And so it's very similar, but it's not the exact same thing. And, like, she does more with it than Jack White does. Like, Jack White does the exact same thing over and over, and she actually changes the pitch a little bit to sing with it as part of the chorus. And so it's...
Yeah, it's so...
It's just
that's like...
So every iteration he made is his property, notes, right? I guess, now.
So that's... Yeah. And so there was... I don't know. Do you watch... what's that show? Silicon Valley?
No, I
don't. There was... basically, I mean, they joked about something like this, but there was a patent troll there who, you know, they, you know, these software guys basically were getting sued by this guy who was like, I want $50,000 or else. And so they go just to try to meet with the guy and negotiate. And he's like, oh, welcome to my office. And he's like super friendly. And he's like, yeah, I'm suing you guys. But yeah, it's really nice to meet you. I really like your software. And then he points, he's like, you see this framed music sheet on the wall. He's like this music sheet, I bought this at an auction, and he's like, these seven notes right here have won me over $50 million over the years, because every song is based on these notes. And it's like, you know, if you think about it, it's like music is made up of what, seven notes, right?
There's 12 notes that you can use, period, to make any song.
So I always thought of this, like, because so when I was younger writing, you know, learning how to write software, I was like, okay, I wonder if we can, like, make music with software. And I was also fascinated with random number generators. And I was like, how many possible combinations can you have of songs? Because there are already thousands of songs out there. You know, if you were to take, so if it's 12 notes and, you know, let's say a bar has like four notes in it, that's 12 to the power of four. That's not a whole lot. And okay, maybe you say we're going to do eight notes. That's not a whole lot. I mean, it's, you know, that gets up to I don't know what, thousands, hundreds of thousands maybe. But if you look at how fast people are putting music out, it's really, you know, especially when you look at hip hop, which is usually just a lot of it's very, very similar, but then they take samples from older songs. It's mostly just the drum beat. You know, what if some guy were like, if there's just like a constant drum beat in the back, that's mine. I own that. You know, all electronic music shares almost the same drum, like bass beat in the back. Like it becomes insane when you kind of look at the extreme examples. But at the same time, you know, what if somebody did copy the exact Seven Nation Army song and play it, and they use the same lyrics and the same instruments and the same notes and everything, and tried to make their copy? Of course it would be, you know, it gets into that thing where, of course, they're already huge, so somebody would recognize it as a knockoff. But you have cover bands, and everyone seems to be okay with the fact that cover bands are out there playing cover songs. That I don't think, have you heard of any cover bands ever getting sued for performing? Well,
no, because venues are not subject to copyright. They're subject to licensing. It's a little different. So they have to purchase basically a license from either two organizations, Broadcast Music International or the Association of Storytellers, Composers, and Poets. they had to pay a fee to have any live music in their venue, and then that fee goes to the artist when they perform their music live, and they turn in the report saying, hey, we performed this here, or this was played on the radio here. So it's a completely different beast for cover bands. Like, the band themselves has to pay nothing, but the venue has to pay.
Interesting. So, and that's just covered over the license. Because, I mean, is that covered in the same license of them being able to install a jukebox or being able to play, have a DJ that plays copyrighted music and all that?
Yeah, if you're going to have music at all in your restaurant or in your library or anything, you have to pay a licensing fee.
Interesting. So, and if you don't, who comes after you?
I don't know if it's the police or if it's those companies' lawyers, but they will find you.
Yeah, I would tend to think it's going to be the lawyers, but yeah, I mean that's interesting, and it would be. I mean, I would hope it's the lawyers. It's if it's the music industry who wants their stuff protected. Now, of course, so we're talking about live music, and you say they have to pay a license to BMI. But of course, if let's say I open a small venue and the artists I'm hiring it's original music, and the artist has no association with BMI or any of those, then that wouldn't be required to pay under that, right?
No, it's only if an artist is registered with BMI or ASCAP that you would have to pay a licensing fee to have their music. Which, again, it's terribly difficult because almost every artist is, because almost every artist doesn't think about how royalties really work. Like, you're basically selling permission to have your music played at every single venue across the country. And then it gets even more complicated if you're an international artist, because each country has their own royalties organization, and you have to collect from that royalty organization, like that, or they have to send it overseas to get your royalties. So it's just a big old worldwide bureaucracy with licensing fees and music.
That's really interesting. But you know, at the same time, it seems like for the most part, it sounds voluntary. Like if you want to get your music distributed within this huge network of you know, publishers and everything else, then it's kind of like the, you know, selling your soul, I guess, but it's what you do so that you can get your music heard around the world. And then there are pros and cons to that, but it's voluntary. So, could this system, this entire, like the BMI system, that was the other one, ASCAP, which, like, I love the name, cause it's like, are they ANCAP? Are they asshats? Like, what do you call that? So ASCAP is the other one. These organizations are mostly voluntary, but could those exist without IP?
Yeah, I think so. Again, like you said, through contracts, like you would register with that kind of like maybe like a consulting firm, and then they would make sure that those venue, like any event that if you want your music to be played at a venue, that venue has signed up with their company. Like, I think it's extremely possible. I think it'd be a lot more difficult, and they'd have to maybe come up with new ideas without the IP laws, but it's definitely possible.
Interesting. Okay, cool. So, let's see. What else is there that's copyrightable or trademarkable? Let's talk about logos like this one, and brands like the hat, that kind of stuff. So. A company, let's use Starbucks as an example, right? Starbucks creates their brand. They have a million stores. They all have the same logo, so that when you go there, you know you're gonna get the coffee's gonna taste exactly the same. The service is gonna be the same. You know, the straws are gonna be kept in the same place, so you know where they are. All of these crazy different things, just based on the name and the logo. So without IP. Could somebody just pop up a new store and say, I'm Starbucks? I think somebody did that. They called it dumb Starbucks or stupid Starbucks or something as like a troll thing. I don't remember exactly what it was. But anyway, what's to stop somebody from starting a real Starbucks, but not giving any of their profits to, you know, not being an actual franchise and giving all their money to the original Starbucks?
There's really nothing, and all that really Starbucks can do is if they know the store is a fake, they can just say, hey, that's not theirs, and, like, send that to every media outlet they know and then make it public knowledge. But, I mean, trademark is one of those things also that it's just really easy to get out of, because all you got to do is change one thing in a logo, and then suddenly it's you know, not part of the trademark. Like, I remember in college, one of our dorm guys, he said that they made a banner for homecoming that had Tony the Tiger on it, and in order to make it so they wouldn't get in trouble, they changed his nose to the color blue, and they made the stripes on his arms like lightning bolts. And that's all they had to do, but everyone knows it's Tony the Tiger still.
Nice. So, I mean, in this situation, like, it seems like, yes, you could go through the effort to just publicly shame that store, but I think then it also creates doubt in the consumer every time they walk into a Starbucks. Well, is this a real one or is this that fake one? I heard it was somewhere around here, but I don't know exactly which one. Would there be a case where you could say, okay, Starbucks can sue the other store, and I know this, you know, this requires government still, but at least it doesn't require specific IP protection. One Starbucks can sue a fake Starbucks because Starbucks, we're already well known in this area. Everybody knows our brand and our logo. And this guy is attempting to pretend to be us, which is basically a common law felony of fraud. He's attempting to delude the entire population that they are serving our product with our service, with our straws in the same location inside the store. I think, to me, that sounds like another way that, you know, you'd have legal recourse by saying, you know, this is, it's a criminal act at that point if you don't at least call it, you know, Arbucks, you know, something a little bit different, or change the color of the logo.
Oh, yeah, I 100% agree. Like, I mean, in my view, a fraud is still a violation of the non-aggression principle, because you, like, people expect to be getting one sort of product, and, you know, what if they go into the fake Starbucks and then, you know, they get sick because that company is not doing it, like, so they're putting their own safety at risk by not going where they think they're going. So, yeah, fraud is definitely still something I think that should be enforceable when people are copying each other's logos or copying each other's products, as, you know, like, as it's still a thing, but then it's not the IP protection where it's like a monopoly. Like, now it's just like them pointing out that they're lying. This is not our product. It's not going to be the same quality as our product. And, like, it could, you know, potentially get you sick, because I don't know what these people do, and I don't want them to do it in our name.
Or, you know, even not to that extreme, you pay them, you know, what is it now, $20 for a cup of coffee, and you get back a cup of coffee that doesn't taste good because it's not authentic Starbucks, and they're like, well, sorry, no refunds. And you're pissed off because you thought it was, you know, a legit Starbucks. Yeah, I mean, that's really, like, you know, and that's actually, I was going to use the example. That's like if I were going around saying, I'm Luke Henderson, you know, that doesn't, like, I'm defrauding people. I'm trying to tell them I'm you. But at the same time, what's really interesting is the way legal aliases work is, you know, you can go around town and you can start giving a different name. You can use, like, you know, a fake name. It's actually a real name as soon as you start using it. It's a different name. You just can't use somebody else's name and pretend to be them. Now, of course, if you just picked a random different name and it just happens that it's the same name as somebody else, because, I mean, you know, realistically, if, you know, if you have a son or a daughter and you give them a name, and, you know, what are the chances that somebody else in the world is going to have the same first and last name? That's an actual possibility. There are, but I've actually found people who are named Daniel Berman, like me. So, you know, for me to, if I had no idea who you were and I started saying, hey, Luke Henderson sounds like a great name, I'm going to start using that. That would actually be legal, and no one would have any reason to, you know, to try to prosecute me or sue me. And then if I found out afterwards, it would be like, oh, hey, that's, what a coincidence, we have the same name. IP would kind of come along and say, well, if you guys are now, you know, the way they would do it with businesses is interesting, because it's like, okay, well, if, let's say we're using the same name, let's go back to the Starbucks example. So let's say one company in California starts a company called Starbucks, and somebody in Nevada comes up and says, I'm going to create a Starbucks. And it's totally by coincidence. They weren't ripping each other off. They both have one store at the time. They're both completely unknown, and then they start growing. And so now the Starbucks in California has 50 chains or 100 restaurants, and the one in Nevada also has 100 restaurants. They start growing and growing and growing, and now they want to start crossing state lines. This, I think, is where, you know, some of the IP laws will come into place by saying, well, you can't operate your business in this state because there's already a business by the same name. Or they might even do it by city. Like when you're filing to get a business license, they're going to say, oh, well, there's already a business with that name. And they'd go by, like, you know, the county keeps a registry of DBAs. Usually, you know, if you're filing a DBA, they'll have you do the research and make sure nobody else is using that name. There's a lot of interesting stuff in there. What do you think about, let me ask that. What do you think about, like, having a government registry, which is really, you know, it's not necessarily a use of force. It's more like a public ledger, like something on Bitcoin would be, for people to say, this is my business and this is what I'm operating as, so that if you wanted to make sure that you weren't using the same business name as somebody else, you could actually do some sort of search first. What do you think about that type of system?
I think that'd be a great system. That's actually something I hadn't thought about, because, like, people, like, really seem like to stay on top of, like, who has their Bitcoin and who does in the blockchain. And so that could be a really good tool to use. And I mean, if you're wanting to start a business, you want to be distinguished. Like, you don't want to be just another hamburger place. Like, you want to be, like, you know, Johnny Rocket's hamburger place, or, you know, Sam the Hamburger Man. Like, you want to do something that makes you different than these other places. And even, I think, in the events, like, because there's already a lot of restaurants across the country that probably have the same name. But what makes them different is the things that they sell, or the things that they do that, like, only they can do, or the things they do that only they do well. So, like, I think that ledger would be a great idea, but also just making sure that your business sticks out. So even if someone else does take your business's name, then you have another way to distinguish yourself. Like, oh, we have the best burger in 3 states, and that place, like, doesn't.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So if, you know, if, let's say, I'm just trying to think of, like, a really generic, like, diner style restaurant, like Bob's or something, right? There might be 1,000 of those restaurants all over the country, and they're not necessarily a chain. They're not associated with each other. They're just, you know, small local diners. And they're not trying to grow and be, you know, the international Starbucks where they're on every corner. And so in that case, it's really, you know, they're all using the same name. They're all a little bit different. And people kind of understand that, I think. They don't look to that as, you know, oh, well, this one's different than the one that's, you know, 3 blocks down with the same name. But at the same time, I don't think it's not really that experience that Starbucks has, where, like, you walk in and it's, like, the exact same layout, the exact same chairs, the, you know, and all that stuff. I think, you know, walking into any of these places, you, like, everything is always different. The menu's different. And you can kind of tell right from that. So it's, but I guess the point is that most of these people don't really care, because they're not trying to become a huge international chain. So the fact that another business is operating with their same name, I don't think makes a huge difference to them.
Yeah, and I think that's an important distinction, that just the biggest users and, like, enforcers of IP are very wealthy companies. Like, it's not really a tool that the everyday community, you know, business uses that much. Like, because I think they figure their clientele knows who they are, because they're trying to make their clientele the people around them. They're not trying to get, you know, people to come over from China to Illinois to get their product. And so, like, that's just a very important distinction. Like, I don't know if you heard recently, but, like, McDonald's lost its trademark in the European Union for the word Whopper. So now Burger King's in the European Union are changing their names to I just said McDonald's and Whopper. That's completely wrong. McDonald's lost Big Mac.
I didn't even catch it.
Yeah, McDonald's lost the trademark to Big Mac, and so now Burger King's and European unions to like make fun of McDonald's have been replacing the word Whopper on their menus to not Big Macs.
To or replacing Big Macs to not Big Macs. Wait. So they're. Hold on. You threw me off with the last one because you said Whopper again.
Yeah. All right. So, yeah, McDonald's lost the trademark to the name Big Mac for their sandwich, right? And so there's Burger Kings in Europe now that to make fun of them have changed the word Whopper on their menus to not Big Macs.
Oh, I see. So Burger King. Okay. Burger King is mocking them.
Yeah.
Nice. That's pretty funny.
So yeah, it's only these wealthy businesses that would have a lot to lose. I don't even know if they really have a lot to lose, like, because everyone knows, even if you walk into a Burger King, you see not Big Macs as the sandwich name, you know they're making fun of McDonald's. You're not thinking like, huh, Burger King has this new sandwich called a Big Mac.
Yeah. That is a really good point. And you know, if Bob's Burgers started selling Big Macs, then I guess that would be, well, but I guess the theory is, so let's say you've spent like billions of dollars in advertising to convince people, hey, when you're hungry, you need a Big Mac. I think the philosophy there is, well, there's only one place where you can get a Big Mac. And that's supposed to be, you know, more specific and different from, you know, convincing them that, oh, when you're hungry, get a hamburger. But at the same time, I don't know who invented the hamburger, but at the same time, somebody invented the hamburger. And what if they would have done the same thing? It's like meat and buns and some other stuff. Could nobody ever copy that? Could there only be one chain ever in the entire world that could make hamburgers? And so there's a specific name with a specific type of hamburger, and they've spent billions of dollars trying to convince people to buy more lots of these. And so now when they want people to get hungry, when people get hungry, they want them to think, okay, I want the Big Mac. And if you could just walk into any hamburger joint, even if it had a different name and a different logo, and they had Big Macs, then I think that's where they would say that's going to hurt us, because people are able to get Big Macs anywhere. But at the same time, you know, it gets to the point of, I guess, you know, they don't want, so two things. One, that's massive corporations who already have massive profits. Not to say that the law shouldn't be applied equally, but do we really have a big, like, should we really, you know, start crying over their small losses? But then the other side is that, do we have, so this company that started advertising this type of thing, would they have invested billions of dollars into advertising the Big Mac if they knew that as soon as they spent all this money, all these other companies would come up and start selling, they'd rename all their hamburgers to Big Macs, just they could profit from that same advertising. It's almost like the difference between, you know, one company advertising, hey, come to our restaurant and get a hamburger, versus the entire meat industry creating an ad that says, go buy more meat. Which, you know, and the meat industry collects their money from, I mean, I guess they get it from pretty much all the meat sales. So it's more of a, I guess, collective socialism type thing. So I don't know. That's an interesting perspective. And does that need to be protected? And if it's not protected, will jobs be lost because companies are going to say, well, I'm not going to invest money into, you know, selling all these burgers. And so we're going to have all these advertising jobs are going to be lost. All these restaurant jobs are going to be lost. Is that an actual concern? Can that be addressed somehow? And should we just not even worry about it?
I mean, it's a concern, yeah, but I think that these companies already know that if they create the right marketing campaign, that they're going to get people to associate something with their product. Like, that's pretty well Geico's whole thing. Like, you know, what does a lizard have to do with Geico? Oh, it's Geico and Gecko. But now you have Geico stuck in your head and you associate it with that lizard. Right. And, like, even if someone started copying that lizard, like, you would still, like, associate it with Geico. You wouldn't associate it with another company. And like then just I think it's just then makes more responsibility on businesses to make sure the consumers know where their locations are. And like I said, the Geico's king of that. They've done the lizard, the caveman, the money that's stalking people. And like this is a whole thing that when I was in school we talked about in marketing, like having something associated with the product that literally has nothing to do with the product is a super effective tool.
Right. Absolutely.
That's why McDonald's has Ronald McDonald.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that was a whole interesting story too. Well, I know we're coming up on time, so I want to start wrapping this up, but,
yeah.
So I saw this movie. It was the McDonald's story. What was it called?
The Founder.
Yeah, that one. And what I thought was really interesting was like, so they went through this whole, like, they went through this whole ordeal. They like, you know, they built up the restaurant and they started creating like millions of them. And at the end, you know, it was kind of like, so the original McDonald's got like, what was it? 5 million or something, like a check. They were promised a lot more that they didn't get, which is fucked up, but they still made like that check that they got was like 100 times more than they ever would have made just operating that one restaurant for the rest of their lives. So what I thought was fascinating was, you know, they were trying to say like, oh, McDonald's is a big evil corporation for that. And it's like, okay, for not keeping their promises. Yes. But they still made these, you know, the original owners very wealthy. Now at the same time, why didn't they just go and say, well, because the whole thing started out, this guy was fascinated with the fact that when you order your burger, it was already ready. So why not just go start his own restaurant and, you know, do it on his own and not have to worry about giving any money to the original creators? And he said that this question was asked in the movie, I think, and he pretty much said, because we wanted your name. We wanted the name McDonald's. And
yeah.
So
that idea of fast food was associated with that restaurant. And you saw in the movie, there was people lined up outside the parking lot because of it.
Well, so, but the reason that they said they liked the word, they liked the name McDonald's, and I don't know how close, you know, the facts are to reality in this movie, but, was because it was a friendly neighborhood name. It wasn't like, you know, a big corporate, like, something sounding name. It was just like, oh yeah, my friend McDonald down the street. Now nobody even thinks about it that way anymore. You think McDonald's and you think like, I don't know, just like coal spewing into the atmosphere in a meat factory and like all kinds of, you know, corporate crap. But you know, it's interesting that it's like, okay, just the name. They really could have used any other name and not had to pay those guys anything. And it might have been just as successful because I, you know, realistically, you know, how much did that name actually play a part of that? I don't think we can. I mean, we'll never really know. But, I mean, Burger King came along and tried to basically copy them, and they've been pretty successful. I mean, they're not number one, but considering they weren't first to market, they've done pretty damn good. So,
and I think there's just something we just, in thinking about IP, is something we just can't avoid. There's going to be evil people who want to take your idea and then use it for themselves. And Ray Kroc, unfortunately, kind of used IP law to his advantage by taking and, you know, making sure that he had ownership of the McDonald's, like, corporate name as opposed to just having ownership of the McDonald's restaurant. And so,
right.
But now Everyone kind of spits on his grave because we know that he did that. So, in the end, I think there's justice.
Yeah, I mean that's a really good point. So in that case, the IP law actually protected the big evil guy and not the guy who got screwed. So, I guess in that case, it's another law that's meant to protect. It doesn't serve justice. It benefits criminals. So that's interesting. All right, awesome. Well, let's wrap it up. It's been really awesome talking with you. I think these are all really great issues that we talked about, all these different facets of IP. Do you want to talk a little bit about your book, if anybody's interested in the book, where they can go to find it?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you want to learn more about my perspectives on intellectual property law, specifically in the realm of music, you can pick up a copy of Igniting Liberty on Amazon, $19.99 for a paperback copy and $5.99 for a Kindle copy. And there's a lot of great essays from there from authors from all around the world. We've got a South African author, we've got an Argentinian author, and we've got authors whose families have come from all over Europe.
Awesome. That sounds really great. So also head over to taxationistheft.cards and get your Taxation is Theft stuff. We've got hats, t-shirts, stickers, mugs, all kinds of cool stuff. And also head over to legalizedpineapplepizza.org. Why not? All right. Luke, it's been really great having you on, and we'll stay in touch, and maybe we'll have you on again and talk some more IP.
Until I'd love then, to. Thanks.
Taxation is Theft.
Taxation is Theft.
Please, at least leave us alone in our living room.
My job is to find the truth.
Double the taxes.
I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Triple the taxes.
This is an IRS agent's dream.
If you think that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourself.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Sorry, but I don't do taxes.
Did you see the memo about this?
The government is a greedy piglet.
Just leave us alone.
Do you know what Ralph just said?
Rhodes.
You boys like Mexico?
Oh!